you will turn your Bibles with me to Leviticus chapter 14. Leviticus chapter 14. That will be our primary text for this morning. I'd like to start by asking if any of you have ever done a yearly Bible reading program. Well, that's not what this lesson is about, but that is a segue into this question. If you were faithful and you didn't complete it, where did you stop? For me, it's usually when I get to Leviticus. That is the killer for a lot of my yearly Bible reading attempts. I get to it, you know, there are some sections I get to and I read it, and I understand that it used to be important to a group of people, and I think, do I really need this? And I just kind of skip over some stuff. I read through, I see what they did, and then I get to some sacrifices and I skip it. Is this really useful to me? That's a question that I ask myself. And not too long ago, I would say, no, it is not useful for me, and I just keep skipping it, and then I get to the action, I get to the narrative. The Bible up until that point is narrative. We start with creation. We get Adam and Eve. We get the fall of the people. We get to Noah and his ark. We get to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. We get to Joseph. And then we get up to Egypt. We get to see how through providence and God's people being there, how Joseph had saved them. Then God sends Moses. Moses, through providence, was saved. Rises up into an area of prominence. And then he leaves. 40 years later, he returns and he leads his people out, and God does all of these great works, all of these great wonders called the 10 plagues. And they leave and they go out into the wilderness, and while they're walking in the wilderness, he gives the law. And when we start going through the law, that's when I start struggling. I see some of these things that aren't, I used to say, not very important. And you get to Leviticus, and there's five chapters of sacrifice laws. There are several chapters after that on cleanliness. And when we get to Leviticus chapter 13 and 14, we start talking about laws on leprosy. And that's what I want to study this morning. Laws concerning leprosy. Now, we have some familiar passages in Leviticus. We try to teach through the Bible, the narrative of the Bible. And about a year ago, I got to teach Leviticus as we were making our way through the Old Testament. I did Leviticus in two classes because there's not a lot of narrative in Leviticus. We spent one whole lesson on Leviticus chapter 10, which is Nadab and Abihu. We're very familiar with that. There are a couple passages in Leviticus that we are familiar with. Chapter 19, verse 18 is one of those. Love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus himself quotes that. We're familiar with that. The rest of my pages are fairly blank. They don't even have the little thumb smudges on the sides of them in the book of Leviticus for me. I don't turn to it a whole lot. But it doesn't mean there's not important things in there. This is one of my favorite lessons. That doesn't mean it's a good lesson. It just means when somebody told me, it really opened my mind to some of the things in the Bible. It made me want to study the Bible more. And I hope that this helps you want to study the Bible more and look at some of these old things and what applications can we make from that. Now, if you will, bear with me, because I want to read a fairly lengthy section of Leviticus chapter 14. I believe that it is better to just read it in its entirety and then go back and make applications on it than to just break it up as we go. So if you will, Leviticus chapter 14. Begin with me in verse 33. Leviticus 14, beginning in verse 33. The Lord further spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, "When you enter into the land of Canaan that I am giving to you as a possession, and I put a spot of leprosy on a house in the land of your possession, then the one who owns that house shall come and he will tell a priest, saying, 'There's something like a spot of leprosy that has become visible to me in the house.' Then the priest will command that they empty the house before the priest goes in to look at the spot, so that everything in the house need not become unclean. And afterwards, the priest will go in and he will look at the house. So he will look at the spot, and if the spot on the walls of the house has a greenish or a reddish depression, and if they appear deeper than the surface or just at the surface, the priest shall come out of the house, and he will come to the doorway, and he will quarantine the house for 7 days. And then the priest shall return on the seventh day, and he will make another inspection. If the spot has indeed spread on the walls of the house, Then the priest shall order them to pull out the stones with the spot on them, and they will throw them away in an unclean place outside of the city. And then he shall have the house scraped away all on the inside, and they shall dump the plaster that they scrape off in an unclean place outside of the city. Then they will take other stones, and they will replace those discarded stones. He will take other plaster, he will replaster the house. And if, however, the spot breaks out again in the house after he has pulled out the stones, after he has scraped the house, after he has replastered the house, then the priest shall come in and he will make another inspection. And if he sees that that spot has indeed spread in the house, it is a malignant spot in the house. It is unclean. The owner will therefore tear down the house and its stones and its timbers, all the plaster of the house. He will take them outside the city to an unclean place. Moreover, whoever goes in that house during the time that he has quarantined it, he becomes unclean until the evening. Likewise, whoever lies down in the house will wash his clothes. Whoever eats in the house will wash his clothes. And if, on the other hand, the priest comes in and he makes an inspection of the spot and it has not spread in the house after it has been replastered, then the priest will pronounce the house clean because the spot has not reappeared. To cleanse the house then, he will take two birds and cedar wood and a scarlet string and hyssop, and he will slaughter one bird in an earthenware vessel over running water. And then he will take the cedar wood and the hyssop and the scarlet string, and with a live bird he will dip them into the blood of the slaughtered bird as well as in running water. And then he will sprinkle the house seven times. And so he will cleanse the house with the blood of the bird and the running water, along with the living bird and the cedar wood and the hyssop and the scarlet string. However, he will let the live bird go free outside the city into an open field. And so he will make atonement for the house, and it will be clean. Question. Why does this matter to me? This is an old law that I am not under. Talking about priests that I am not under. A covenant that I am not under. And I'll go a step further. I am under a better law. I'm under a better covenant. I have a better high priest. Why should Leviticus chapter 14 matter to me? And this is the lesson that I would like to present as it was presented to me about 2 years ago now. By examining God's law for dealing with leprosy, that can help us dealing with sin. Leprosy is a physical description of sin as it inhabits our spiritual bodies. Are we vigilantly looking for it? How do we go about solving it? How do we go about removing it from our lives? How do we see it? What actions must we take? Biblically, as we look through this description of sin, we get to see what leprosy does to people, what sin does to people. And then physically, we start to notice that's a lot like sin is described. Leprosy was ugly. It was nasty. You know, it would change people's faces, the way that they looked. It could cause loss of fingers, loss of digits, loss of limbs. It could cause uncleanliness. It led to uncleanliness. And it was incurable, at least at the time. There was nothing you could do about it. Not only was it ugly, it was a contaminant. It made other things dirty. It could be deeper than the skin. It wasn't just something physical. It went inside of you. And if you back up into Leviticus chapter 13, when it's talking about leprosy on a person, it says it can be deeper than the skin. It's more than something that's just superficial. And not only is it something that's on the outside of you, it is something that spreads. It's something that is infectious. It is something that corrupts a body, and it can corrupt other bodies. And it isolates. You know, it led to the Jews being thrown outside of the city as they were unclean. Those people, they had to cover their mouths. They had to scream, unclean, unclean. It was incredibly embarrassing. It was incredibly heartbreaking. As they were separated from family, from friends, from their people, it led to them being isolated and left alone. And interestingly, in chapter 13 as well, those leprous garments that they wore, they were only fit to be burned. The things, the items they possessed, they became worthless. They were only fit to be destroyed. Does any of that sound familiar as we start to compare that to sin? Now, sin is ugly. Sin is something that is, at least on our own, it was incurable, much like leprosy at the time was. It is something that is within a person because it's a heart issue. It is deeper than the skin. Sin is not something that just affects us. Sin spreads. Now, one person convinces another, and then they convince another, so on and so forth. It spreads. It's dangerous. It isolates people. It leads to people being withdrawn from, being cut off from their own family and from God, most importantly. It's very dangerous. And we all know the wages of sin and those who are in it. Fit for death and fit to be burned, much like those leprous garments. So when my friend called me 2 years ago and he says, "Hey, have you ever looked at Leviticus chapter 14 and compared that with sin?" Well, all of a sudden I started thinking, well, maybe I needed to start reading the whole book of Leviticus a little better, and maybe there's some other stuff in there that I hadn't paid attention to. And so that's what I would like to look at, is these similarities between sin and leprosy, and then maybe how they dealt with leprosy. That can help us remove sin from our lives. That can help us be clean, like the homes that they were trying to get better. So I would like to break this section that we read in its entirety, break it up into four smaller sections. And we'll make an application with each one of those. First, it began with detecting that there was a problem to begin with. You'll notice in verses 33 to 35, who was it that found it? You know, there was an issue, and if you're not aware of the issue, you don't know that you need a solution. When I walk through our house, I don't notice little things. That is what I determined to be my wife's job. Mallory is incredibly detail-oriented. I am not. She has moved entire furniture out of our house, and I didn't even know it was gone for months. That's just how I am. I don't look for those things, but you will notice that there is a reason for things. You have to be aware of issues. The book of Romans begins with an excerpt on what sin is and how important it is, because they're writing to mostly Gentiles. They don't know these things. You have to explain what sin is so that you understand how dangerous sin is. And that is the first thing that those Romans needed to know, or the Christians that were there. What is sin? What does it do to me? How do I get rid of it? Do you understand the consequences of this? A lifeboat is not a very precious thing to me. But when your ship is sinking, or when you are in the ocean and you're floating, a lifeboat's one of the most precious things you've ever seen. We have to understand the gospel is not valuable unless you understand how dangerous sin is. The gospel is not valuable unless we know that we could lose our very souls over this. Romans starts this way, and this passage in Leviticus starts this way. Do you understand that there's leprosy in your house? You need to be looking for it. They didn't have random leprosy spot checks. They didn't have priests coming and knocking on the doors, say, "Oh, it's time for me to look to see if you've got leprosy." When I was in school, I don't think that they still do this, but we used to have to put our heads on our desk, and the teacher would come through, and they'd look through our hair trying to find lice. And then one day we had a kid get caught. He comes back bald the next day. He didn't look as good as Preston did, but he had the shaved head. They didn't have people looking for him. We don't have that. It was the homeowner's job. We'll notice that in verse 35. It is his job to come and look at his own house. And when he notices it, what does he do? He's supposed to go tell a priest. He's supposed to go to a priest. He says, "You know, I think I have an issue. There's a spot on my wall. You need to come examine it. Can you come check this out for me?" You'll notice, you know, the owner may not be as studied as that priest, in at least the old law. But he knows that something's not right. He knows something's not correct. There is something that might be of concern. So will you come look at it? He knows who he needs to go to for help. He is commanded to go to this person for help. So for the homeowner to know that, would he not have to be paying attention? Are we paying attention? Have you ever been to somebody's house and there's just stuff wrong with it? And they just act like it's okay. Mallory and I we buy foreclosed homes and we fix them. There's always something wrong with our house. But occasionally you go to somebody's house and it's just dangerous. And they live in it. You walk in and there's load-bearing walls and it's got major cracks all along the side. You ask them about it. And they're like, "Yeah, it does that sometimes. Sometimes those cracks spread, but it's been okay so far." You don't understand how dangerous this could be. You know, you start hearing beeping going off. You know, what is that? That's just our CO2 detector. It goes off sometimes. We got to get out of the house. It's dangerous. Do you not understand what is wrong with this? You just want to fix it for them. You want to help them. They're not paying attention to the signs. Sometimes there's a spot of leprosy on our house. Sometimes there is some sin in our home. Do we notice it? Do we detect it? Do we try to get rid of it? So they have to notice that there is an issue. They have to be vigilant. They have to be looking. You know, they have to have somebody who goes, "Oh, this isn't right." So he goes to the priest and he brings them in. And as we compare sin and leprosy, it starts with vigilance. It starts with paying attention. It starts with looking, trying to be detail-oriented. Yep. We have to be on our guard at all times. We talked earlier in the previous lesson, Satan walks about as a roaring lion looking for those he may devour. He has no off days. He does not sleep. He does not stop. He is constantly trying to get us to fall. We must be vigilant. We have to be looking. Sin is a malignant force. It is spreading. It is growing. And if we're not careful, it will spread into us. Or it can spread from us into another individual. And if we are not looking, if we are not watching, it will get us. And as sin is malignant, Satan is malicious, always trying to get us, always trying to get us and the ones that we love. If you will, turn to Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21. Jesus here is talking about expecting an impending judgment. And in Luke chapter 21, he says this. Look in verse 34. But be on your guard, so that your hearts will not be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and the worries of life, and that this day will not come on you suddenly like a trap. That kind of reminds me of the days of Noah. Noah constantly saying, constantly preaching, hey, something's going to happen. We've got to be wary. We've got to be looking. We've got to be on guard, because when it comes, it will be too late. People didn't listen. We have to notice that there is an issue in our homes. We have to be paying attention. We have to be vigilant. We have to be on guard. But now, back in Leviticus chapter 14, imagine that this is our house. Imagine this is your house. And you notice a spot on the wall. You know, it walk by and you notice it's starting to get a little bit bigger, a little bit more unsightly, and you know what you need to do. I need to go see this priest. I need to get him to come inspect it. I need him to look at it. And then you start thinking, if I go get the priest and I tell him and people see him walk up and he comes into my house, they're going to know something's wrong with my house. And they're going to see me and they're going to say, hey, there's that guy with leprosy in his house. He's kind of nasty. He's unclean. He has problems. I don't have those. I probably don't want to associate with him. And as we continue to snowball these things, well, now we just don't want to go talk to the priest at all. And we just let it keep growing on the wall over there. We let it keep getting bigger. Our pride gets in the way of us doing what we know we need to do, because we're worried about what other people think. Our pride makes us want to cover up that problem. Instead of removing a section of the wall, we just put a picture on top of it so people can't see it. We cover it up, we hide it, instead of removing it. Now, we need not only vigilance, we need humility. We need humility that goes over our pride so that we can admit that we have a problem. In Luke chapter 18, we won't turn there, but that's when Jesus is talking about two men who were praying. And one of those men was a tax collector, and that man knew he had a problem. And he was humble enough to admit to God. He said, be careful. Take care of me, a sinner. I need your help. He admitted that. He was willing to. The Pharisee was not. He just said, thank you for all the things and that I do for you. Do you know how great I am? He hid the spots on his wall. He wanted people to know how good he was. That tax collector was willing. He was honest. He was humble enough to admit that he had problems. We can't cover these things up. We have to be vigilant. We have to be looking. So while we need to be looking for problems, once it was detected in the house, you'll notice that it had to be examined. It had to be looked at. We had to go further into this issue. Now, the priest was notified. The man was able to admit. He was humble enough to admit that he had a problem, that there was something wrong in his house. So he went and he brought this priest, and the priest had to look. And there was a litany of things. There was a list that he had to go through. He had to look. Is it greenish? Is it reddish? Is it something that's just on the surface of that wall, or is it deeper? Does it go into the plaster? Does it go into the stones? And, you know, even though the homeowner found the issue, it wasn't up to his discretion on how big of an issue it was. He had to go to another authority to find out how deep this problem was. Is this a serious infection? And I believe that sometimes I do this with sin. Maybe we can do this with sin. You know, we look at sin in our lives. I look at sin in my life, and I think, oh, I can deal with this. I don't need to tell anybody. I don't need to tell anyone. I'll take care of it. I can fix this on my own. I think of Mike Gundy. Gave an incredible speech one time. I'm a man. I'm 40. I can handle it. Well, I'm not 40, but even at 30, I feel like I'm a man. I can handle it. I can deal with this. I don't need help. We can't do that with sin. We can't just write our own prescription, as it were, on how to deal with this. There is a higher authority that we have to go to. And just like those Israelites had to go to a priest to come in and determine how big of an issue something was, we have an authority that we need to look to as well. If you will, turn to John chapter 5. John chapter 5. It's just a few pages over. This parallels who our judge is. This parallels how he is going to judge us. In John chapter 5, look in verse 30. John chapter 5, verse 30. Jesus says, I can do nothing on my own, and as I hear, so I judge. My judgment is righteous, because I do not seek of my own will, but of the will of him who sent me. And that sounds a lot like that Levitical priest. That Levitical priest sent by God to go look and determine things, make judgments on how serious an issue is. We also have a priest, and our high priest is much more official, much better than that Levitical priest. And he makes judgments, not on his own will, but of God's. We have a judgment. We have the Word of God. It is the standard by which we do all things, and we are bound by that Word. In Psalm 119, we will not turn there, but in verse 9, how can we keep sin out of our lives? We have to guard our path. We have to keep it clean. We have to keep it pure. We have to try to keep the sin out of our lives. But you will notice as the priest comes in, he didn't make a judgment right away. He didn't just snap his fingers and go, leprosy, tear the house down. He'd walk in and say, leprosy, kick these people out of the city. He gave it time. There are things that he waited. He used wisdom. He gave it time, either to worsen or to improve. And as he looks at these things, he made no snap decisions. There was no jumping to conclusions. That's just a human ideal. Sometimes we do that. I do that. I very much do that. I jump to conclusions immediately. I see something happen. That's what it is. I know how it worked. I know how it got there. And I can put a whole system of how we went from here to here to here. And I make judgments. That's not right. I don't need to do that. Now, sometimes we can get caught up in this. But what we really need to do is examine things carefully. We need to use wisdom in doing those things. In Joshua 22, you remember as they went through and they began the conquest of Canaan, there were some people who were on the east side. They came up of the Jordan River and they said, hey, this is great land. Moses, just let us have this land. Joshua, let us have this land. And they got mad. They said, no, we can't do that. They thought they didn't want to fight with them. They said, no, we just want this land. It's great pasture. This will be good for us. We'll still help you take over the rest of Canaan on that west side of the Jordan River. I said, okay, so they finish their conquest. They make their way north and they come back through. And then they go to cross the Jordan River as they go to leave, and they build an altar. And they build an altar and they say, hey, this is an altar to remind us when we see it, when our children see it, that we still serve the God of Israel. Even though we're not living with the other 10 tribes over there, when we're on this side, we'll see that altar and we'll know this is our God. We are still a part of these 12 tribes, even though we're separated by this river. Now, some of the other 10 tribes heard about this altar and they saw it. And they didn't go ask the people about it. They did the logical thing. They said, these people have forsaken God. They have built an altar that they should not have built. We have to kill every one of them. So they gather a whole army and they come up to the Jordan River, and as they're about to cross, somebody finally has the idea of, they say, hey, what is this altar for? And they told them. So this is, we're still part of you. We still serve this God. And then those 10 tribes say, that's a great idea. I'm glad you built this altar. This is a good thing. They're ready to kill them just a few moments prior because they jumped to conclusions. They didn't wait. They didn't use wisdom. They didn't use insight. They just jumped to conclusions. The priest, likewise, could not jump to conclusions. He gave it a week. He gave it time so he could use wisdom, so he could look at things and see how it changed. Sometimes we can do that with sin, and we need to do that with sin. I'm not saying that we can't look and say, that is sin. But sometimes we can maybe jump off the handle just a little bit. In Matthew 18, verse 15, we see this in the New Testament. We're told to speak alone, and then if that doesn't solve our problem, we bring it before two or three people. And if that still doesn't fix your problem, we'll bring it before the church. And while I understand that may be talking about specifically pressures on trying to turn an individual back to God as you continue to bring more people into it and they're faced with the error of their ways, there may also be a timeliness aspect to this. Now, it is very easy today for me to be upset with someone and then I just send a text message or a Facebook post or Instagram or Twitter or whatever, and I can just blast a person to everybody immediately. It is very easy for me to jump to conclusions and spread to a bunch of people knowledge that may not be correct. But in times where you had to travel word by mouth, It took time for you to speak to your brother. And as you walk back and you go to talk to two others and you're going to tell them, well, you have time to think about some things, to reflect on some things, a conversation that you just had. You speak with those two people. They're able to talk, give you their ideals as you work your way back to that person, your brother that you have an issue with. And then if it's still not, you're able to bring it before the church. It gives us time. It gives us wisdom. It gives us a timetable of being able to look at things objectively without flying off the handle. So while we have these detection issues as we look through our homes, we have to notice that sin is there. We have to be vigilant, always on the lookout. Then we have to examine it. We have to come in, we take it, and we give it time. We run it through certain tests. We learn it. We examine things against God's law. Is this sin? Is it not? How do we need to deal with it? You'll notice that the next step was that they had to treat the problem. You know, this is leprous. The results have come in, and this is definitely sin. So step one, they remove the infected plaster. And then they would remove the stones, and they would take them outside the city. They didn't immediately just demolish the whole house. They removed what was necessary. And then they had another period of waiting, see what happens, see how it goes. They gave it more time. You know, there are different... Let me start over. The way that we remove sin from our lives, it varies based on the sin. Sometimes to remove sin from our lives, you just don't need to walk down a specific aisle in a store. Sometimes you don't need to walk in that store at all. Sometimes maybe you just don't need to drive down the street that store is on. And sometimes you might have to throw away your car keys. There are different levels to removing sin from our lives. Sometimes maybe I just don't need to watch a certain commercial that comes on. Maybe I don't need to watch that channel, or I don't need to pay for a subscription that gives me access to certain channels. Sometimes I need to throw my TV away. There are different levels, and some of those levels of removing sin are monumental. Sometimes it's very small, sometimes it's very easy. It differs from person to person, from sin to sin, on basis to basis. Things that you may struggle with, I may not think is a problem at all. And there may be some things that I struggle with that you say, oh, that's crazy. How can you not deal with this? We all struggle in individual ways, in different ways. But we have to remove things that cause us to sin. We have to remove those things from our lives, regardless of what they may be. Things that cause sickness in our homes. You'll notice as we read, they repeated things over and over. Where did they remove those things to? An unclean place outside the city. An Israelite garbage dump is what it was, for lack of a better word. They took them far outside the city, outside of smell, outside of sight, outside of mind. They didn't want it anywhere near them. They didn't want to acknowledge it. It was unclean. It was nasty. They had no recycling program for it. It was there, it was gone, and it burned until it was gone. If you will turn to the 101st Psalm. Are we trying to keep sin close? The 101st Psalm, David talks about how he views sin, how he views people who sin, how he views people who are righteous. Sometimes I feel like we see God's law as it has been dictated to us as just a line in the sand. And sometimes we feel like, well, I can get as close to that line as I possibly can, and that means I'm okay. That's not how David looked at it. That's not how David dealt with sin. The 101st Psalm. Look with me in verse 1. David says, I will sing of mercy and justice. To you, O Lord, I will sing praise. I will carefully attend the blameless way. When will you come to me? I will walk within my house in the integrity of my heart. I will set no worthless things before my eyes. I hate the work of those who fall away. It will not cling to me. A perverse heart will leave me, and I will know no evil. Whoever secretly slanders his neighbor, him I will destroy. I will not endure one who has a hardy look or an arrogant heart. My eyes will be upon the faithful of the land, that they will dwell with me. One who walks in a blameless way is one who will serve me. One who practices deceit, he will not come within my house. One who speaks lies will not maintain his position before me. Every morning I will destroy all the wicked of the land so as to eliminate from the city of the Lord all who do injustice. Do we keep sin close? Because David is not. David did not. David wanted it as far away from him as he could. He didn't want it in his house. He didn't want it in his service. He didn't want it in his city. He wanted it outside in the unclean place, out of his sight, out of his thought. In 2 Kings 23, Josiah comes into power. And this is after a terrible couple of kings in Judah's history. Josiah comes in, and you notice as you read 2 Kings 23, you just look at some of the verbs. He burned a lot of things. He beat and broke a lot of things. He scattered things. He removed things. He defiled things. Idols, groves, places of worship of false gods. He got those out of his city, all in order to return Israel to a clean state. He had to start over. And he did that by removing everything that he could find to get sin out of his city, out of God's city, so that his people could start doing righteous things, holy things, godly things. Too often, I think it's possible that we see what we're told not to do. We can get in a thou shalt not mentality. Start thinking, oh, I can't do this, and I can't go there, and I can't eat this, and I can't drink this, and I can't watch this, and I can't do this. And we just spiral into this negative thought of, I have to remove all of this, and I can't do anything. And that's not how God designed us to remove those things from our lives. If you will turn to Ephesians chapter 4, this is when Paul is talking about the old man and the new man. In Ephesians chapter 4, he says we've got to remove some things. Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 20. You did not learn Christ in this way. If indeed you have heard him and you have been taught him, just as truth is in Jesus, that in reference to your former way of life, you are to rid yourselves of the old self that is being corrupted in accordance with lust of deceit, and you are to be renewed in the spirit of your minds. You are to put on a new self, which in the likeness of God and has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. And you read that and they hear that and they think, well, great. Now I can't do anything. I've just got to get rid of everything I ever did. And now my life is boring. And Paul, thankfully, gives them specific examples of how we remove that old life. Now look in verse 25. Therefore, you rid yourselves of falsehood. Speak now each one of you with truth to his neighbor, because we are parts of one another. You say, well, Paul, I'm a habitual liar. Everything I say is a lie. If I take lies out, well, then I just can't talk at all. Well, that's not what Paul said. It's not what God said. He said, you replace that with truth, and that's all you'll speak. You replace the evil, the lies, the falsehoods. You replace that with truth, with honesty, with godliness. That's what you're going to speak now. And you say, well, that's great. But listen, I'm a kleptomaniac, and I take everything that I can possibly find. Oh, that gives you another example. Look with me, if you will. Look in verse 28. The one who steals, he must steal no longer. Rather, let him labor, producing with his own hands what is good, so he will have something to share with the one who has a need. If you're a thief, you will steal no more. Not only are you not going to steal things, you're going to take things with your hands. Well, now you're going to make things with your hands. Not only are you going to make things with your hands, it's not going to be just for you. Now you're going to give it to people who are in need so that they won't have to take things. Your hands are going to be so busy doing good things, you're not going to have time to take things from other people. You replace the evil with the goodness, with the holiness. You get rid of that old man and you become a new man. You fill that void with good, holy things. We replace that negative with better, godly, positive things. So now we have identified that there is sin in our life. There's leprosy in our house. We've examined that leprosy. We've examined that sin. We've determined, well, this is an issue. I probably need to take some of this out. I need to remove some things. And sometimes that means removing a whole wall. Sometimes it means removing a small little picture of plaster. Sometimes it means you tear your house down. Regardless, we have done things to remove that sin from our homes, to remove that sin from our lives. And then we've rebuilt. We've replaced that small section of the wall, or the whole wall, or the house. We've rebuilt it. Now it is relatively clean. It is better. But why is there still more? Why is there an entire section of atonement? The answer is because we hadn't really fixed the problem. We've done all of these things. We've removed the sin. We've removed the leprosy from our lives. But if that fixed the problem, why do I need Jesus? The answer is because it doesn't matter if I remove this sin from my life, I no longer do it anymore. There is atonement that must take place. There's something else that is needed that is beyond what I can do, what we can do physically. We can only take the steps we are told to do. We've removed sin from our lives. There's something else that is required. It's the exact same at the end of Leviticus chapter 14. Yep. Used to, that would have been the section that I would have skipped the most. As soon as it starts saying that you take the hyssop and you take the scarlet string and you take this wooden bowl, that's when I tune out and I skip down to the next section where it tells what they're supposed to do, because I don't offer Old Testament sacrifices. I don't want to, you know, have my brain where I'm only thinking about all these animals and what they're useful for. There's other things that I might think is more important. That's what I need to take and I need to remember and I need to spend my time studying on. And that's not true. Because this is the most important section of Leviticus chapter 14 when it talks about the sacrifice that was necessary. It talks about the atonement that was necessary. If you will, turn to John chapter 8. John chapter 8. In the 8th chapter of John, beginning in verse 34, Jesus says this. Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone that commits sin is a slave of sin. Now the slave does not remain in the house forever, but the Son does remain forever. So if the Son sets you free, then you truly will be free." We need Jesus because of what He has done for us. We need Jesus to wash our sins clean. We need Jesus to declare us holy. Because we can't just remove the sin from our lives and stop sinning. Because that doesn't remove the previous sin from our lives. That doesn't make our house holy, our body, our soul holy and clean. It has to be atoned for. We can't do it ourselves. One final point before we close. Did you notice exactly what that sacrifice was at the end of Leviticus chapter 14? The thing that I would skip over the most. They took two birds and they sacrificed one of those birds. And they took the second bird and they washed it in the blood of the sacrificed bird. And it arose clean. And they set it free. We can remove sin from our lives. That does not make us washed clean. We have to be washed in the blood of our sacrifice. We have to be washed in the blood of Jesus through baptism. We have to be risen. And then we can be atoned for. Then we can be clean. Then we can have that sin removed from our lives. And we do the very best we can to maintain that sinless position, maintain that cleanliness, that holiness, that godliness. If there's anybody who needs to do anything, if there's any soul that needs to be atoned for, that needs to be cleaned, please do so as we sing the song of invitation.